When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wednesday, which means it's time for the front three with me, Adam Boltwood, the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Welcome back.
That's when you say something, yeah. And of course, the man, the myth, the legend, Kristen Hennage.
Good evening.
Stepping in for Dave this week, who's away skiing in the Alps, having the time of his life right now. Probably just as well, seeing as how bad things are going at Old Trafford. We wouldn't want him to have a meltdown here on the podcast. We are going to be
definitely
talking.
Definitely don't have a meltdown if you're skiing.
I wonder what his slope completion rate is.
Exactly. We will be talking, Louis, about how Everton transfer news. We've also got our talking point tonight, which is all about Pep Guardiola, with journalist Kit Holden joining us. Make sure you subscribe to Front Three on iTunes. If you're feeling particularly nice, go and give us a little review. Maybe rate the podcast as well. All you have to do is search the Front Three on your podcast app and click on write a review. It is that easy.
Don't forget, can I just say, Give it 5 stars.
If you're that way inclined, that would be very nice.
Obviously, give it 4, that's more believable.
All right, Kristen, steady on, mate.
Yeah.
Nice reviews this week, we had one from Zarkoon. He said, been listening to the podcast since episode 1, loved every single episode. Lawrence, you're brilliant. Dave, you're hilarious. And Adam, you sew it all together. Very nice there. Also, Cameron Falkus saying, enjoyed the piece on Ibar last week, which I was very happy to hear about. Thank you, Cameron. But comment of the week has to go to JJD1681816. Who left us the review saying that he'd have the Front Three theme song playing at his wedding with Dave as his best man, giving me stats.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, on the first date, he completed
exactly,
10 take-ons. You
know, all sorts of.
Your future wife shagged 14 blokes in 10 years.
I mean, he said it, not me. I think we should move on swiftly from that. And
that's the first in the top 5 leagues in Europe.
We should move straight into Liverpool, Lawrence. Liverpool are through to the League One Cup final after beating Stoke on penalties, of course.
Yeah. Deserved? I never thought I'd say this, but can I hear more from Kristen?
Oh, of course. I mean, we'll come on to Kristen. There'll be plenty of Kristen in this podcast.
You bloody won't, you dirty guest.
Don't you worry. Oh, God. Oh, apologies, Dad. Lawrence, deserved?
Over the two legs, I think Liverpool played some good football. I think that tactically they probably played it the way they wanted to. No one sort of plans to go 1-0 down to an offside goal. And then obviously there was a lot of defending for Liverpool to do against. Actually, I was surprised how deep Stoke's team went tonight. You know, they were bringing on some impressive subs as the game went on. And so I was sitting there like, right, who are Liverpool going to bring on?
Did you not think Stoke performed well? I thought they played reasonably well. They looked more dangerous going forward than Liverpool did.
Yeah, although I think that was the plan. Liverpool did want to draw Stoke onto them, and then their counter-attack was not so effective. Benteke came on. I thought Benteke tried to hold the ball up again a little bit higher up. You could see he was trying to get even further up the pitch. So at least there's some sort of progression there, but it wasn't a classic semi-final.
It was not. Penalties are fun, though.
Stretch the imagination. Penalties are fun. It was a
nice
good
to see
penalty shootout.
Saving two.
Yeah, you know, one penalty shootout does not make a goalkeeper. but
Jamie
he has
Carragher
had a few good penalty
say.
Shootouts now for Liverpool. And obviously people at the other end thinking that Jack Butland, just because he's had a good night and because he is apparently a penalty specialist, would bring Stoke through in this one. Also good to see John Flanagan back and Alberto Moreno being absolutely
torn to shreds.
Yeah. Good use of that phrase by Jurgen Klopp. I don't know if it was for being too high up the pitch or It's definitely interesting.
I think he may have been neglecting his defensive duties somewhat, as he tends to
level that criticism at him over the full 90 minutes.
Of course, Joe Allen scoring the winning penalty in the end, Twitter exploding into Perlo and Welshavy memes within seconds. But
it's trending.
It is actually trending now. Excellent. Yeah. But obviously, tomorrow night, well, I should say tonight is the big game. Manchester City v Everton. Who would you rather be facing? Obviously, the local rivals or potentially a team who you'd expect to be the favourites if they did get through to the final in Manchester City?
Yeah, I think Liverpool would much rather face Everton. Not only because of the style, but also because it would just be a Scouse derby. And that's a much bigger event than a playing against Man City. So Liverpool want Everton in the final. Obviously, you want to see your City rivals do well. You want to see Liverpool as a City do well. And obviously with, you know, all the stuff that's going on, Roberto Martinez, Ed, I don't know if we're going to talk about that at some point tonight. But, you know, there's a lot going on at Everton at the moment. A lot of question marks over him. So it'd be good to see him.
Of question marks. Kristen, any thoughts on Liverpool's momentous victory before we move on?
I thought they were quite slow in attack again tonight. I think there's potentially an interesting parallel between a lack of confidence and a lack of movement in teams when they get to the final third. And I think that really bears itself out with Liverpool at the minute.
Who do you think doesn't look confident? Do you think Milner? I mean, I think Lallana was the main impetus, but then he just seemed to take the ball. You know, energy doesn't make an attack, does it? You have to have intelligence, almost have velocity ahead of just speed.
I think a lot of them look bereft of confidence. Benteke is a good example. I don't think he carries himself in the same way that he did last season with Villa. Firmino in patches, I think his kind of flicks between both ends of the pole, I think, as he's trying to kind of adjust. It's just a difficult watch sometimes with Liverpool at the minute in attack, and it's not something that I see. Yeah, that's the problem, is everybody refuses to move, and I think there comes a point
especially Benteke.
I think some people are confused to move, and so they just end up not.
That's the thing.
They almost freeze.
It comes to a point where you stop saying that it's just understanding. It's clearly something a little bit more deeper rooted than that.
To be fair to Benteke, lovely penalty. Lovely little stuttered run up, bosh in the corner.
I thought they were against the rules. I could have saw someone.
You're not allowed to completely stop. You're allowed to, as long as you keep moving forward. If you stutter but keep moving, then it's fine. No worries. Oof. Right then, let's move on to Louis van Gaal. Kristen, keen to get your thoughts on the Dutchman, seeing as we talk about it every week, and we obviously have usually a very upset Dave talking to us about him. Another disappointing
just
result.
Just free associating about football most of the time.
Another disappointment.
We need to sign people, but then we also need youth, but then we need to sign people.
Oh, he's always furious.
We need youthful experience.
But obviously, another disappointing result of the weekend. Another, was it one shot on target, I think? Reports after the game that he'd offered to resign. This is apparently the third time he's offered to resign. I think this came from Jamie Jackson in The Guardian. The club have come out yesterday and said, you know, none of that is true. But either way, Kristen, to me, it feels like he's a dead man walking.
I think till the end of the season, pretty much. He knows his fate and when it's going to happen. It just doesn't fit anymore. That's the difficulty. Is you can lament his tactics, you can lament his style all you like. I think you have to accept that, simply put, it's not a good match. The style of play for the Premier League, I think personally the Premier League is quite rudimentary in terms of its tactics and how teams actually set up. I don't think you need as much structure as he is trying to apply to the team. And consequently, they're sat, you know, kind of passing it around and trying to be intricate when I don't necessarily think they need to. I think they could be a lot more bullish with the ball and use players like Memphis, who are incredibly direct and aren't the most subtle of attackers. And yet I think he's almost unwilling to kind of see the Premier League for what it is, and that is his stubbornness coming through, and it's something that's been throughout his career. And as they say, sometimes your greatest strength can also be your greatest weakness, and we're watching that unfold with Man United on a weekly basis now.
Do you really think he's got until the end of the season? I feel like as soon as the UCL is mathematically out of reach, he's going to be gone, which of course is too late by that point.
Possibly. I think there is a strong case to be made, as you said there, that he could fall foul of the David Moyes situation, whereby the second they miss out on that, he goes as well. It's just who you replace him with, realistically. I wouldn't be surprised if they're sounding out replacements now, if they're trying to build that contingency plan now.
Mourinho's writing his letters, right? He's given his pitch, or so it's reported. Right. Yeah. So it's reported on the weekend, of course.
He's not.
Well, you know, there was the you know, the thought that he's done this before with certain clubs. It was said that he did it with England. He's done it with Barcelona, reportedly. He's not necessarily written a letter.
Well, yeah, I respect Miguel Delaney as a journalist. I think he's really fantastic. And I'm sure there is a source that he has that says he wrote something. I just don't know. I don't know if I sort of buy that Mourinho would need to do that, considering that he has. First of all, why would he bypass his agent, who would also just definitely never say to him, it's probably best we write a six-page letter here.
Well, front and back.
What everyone says is that he's so desperate for this job. You know, you hear the stories about how he cried when he was passed over for the job when Sir Alex Ferguson retired.
If you're trying to change your image, that's a really good way to do it. To be humble enough to write a letter to a club explaining why you think you would be for it. Look at the way it's normally handled. As Lawrence touched on there, you go through an agent, you meet in a hotel, it's all very businesslike. If you go for that more emotive approach and you write them a letter and be very kind of humble about it, for someone in Mourinho's position, I would argue from a PR standpoint, that's probably the best way to do it.
Well, I think he is in, Lawrence, you're sort of saying he's not in a position where he has to do that. You know, look at everything he's won, look at his stats in the game. I'd argue he is in a position where he has to do that because of what's happened at Chelsea this season. That's obviously a big dent on his reputation, and of course because of the thought that his style, that his the way he conducts himself is not in line with Manchester United, so he needs to sell himself to Ed Woodward.
Yeah, but I think also people kind of I don't know that they it's almost like people like to see them they like to see themselves as the exception to the rule, and I believe United like to see themselves as the exception to the rule when it comes to managers, all these sorts of things, but, you know, the way they describe themselves, you know, the way they market themselves, just everything. And so you'd imagine they don't see themselves above that, but they don't want to get dragged into the mire with everyone else because it would almost reveal partly that Manchester United is the same as everyone else underneath. And that's part of the problem, I think, for Manchester United is the past few years just been a slow realization that they are just a football club.
Look at the way they view themselves, though. Look at the way that we saw Adam talk the other day on the Football Republic about Dave Sexton, how he was sacked despite having 11 wins on the trot, and the idea that they don't care if they just win anymore, they want to win beautifully. Mourinho's not in that mould. He's all about winning, period. He doesn't really care about any footnotes you add to those victories.
But he can. But the point would be that he can win. But it's not like he's never had a not so pretty side. He's never played the most beautiful football. But it's not like he's never not had a pretty side. You know, they have played. You know, Robin was very beautiful. Duff is a beautiful footballer. Drogba was considered beautiful in certain ways. So I think Mourinho, you know, he does paint broader brushstrokes than just, you know, defence, attack.
The difficulty is, though, is when you have his mentality, if you don't get the results, it's almost like Tony Pulis in that sense. If you don't get the results, people really start to turn on you quickly because they look at it as, hang on, we brought you in to win. And if you're not winning, what else are you doing for us?
Well, Chris,
because he's not always building a legacy. He's not someone that's brought through young players either, as much as I kind of... In fact, if I remember right, he sanctioned the sale of Davide Santon at Inter, who's now gone back there.
It does seem to be a bit of a mismatch, doesn't it, between the club and the potential manager.
Massively. I think it's a legacy. That's why he wants this club.
Well, Chris, if you're Ed Woodward, right, what do you do right now? Do you sack Louis van Gaal? In the words of Andy Tate, give it Giggsy till the end of the season. Do you bring in Mourinho? Do you stick with Van Gaal? If you were Ed Woodward, what would you do right now?
I think stick with...
I'd quit. fucked up here.
All right, that's what Lawrence would do.
I'm sorry.
That's what you'd do. You'd fall on your sword.
Take a big sip of whiskey.
Yeah.
I think... What I would do is I would get rid of Van Gaal and put Giggs in to send a subtle message that what has been witnessed is not acceptable. First and foremost.
Very subtle.
Very subtle.
As subtle as you can be, realistically.
And would you
without
sort of,
coming out,
you
know, and saying
there's suggestions
he's
that he should be surrounded with certain people who can and help him until the end of the season?
Sir Alex Ferguson not to have an official role, but certainly oversee things with him. Just to give him a little bit of extra help, just to give him a little bit of experience that you necessarily can't buy at the moment. And then I would make the biggest possible play for Pep Guardiola, assuming that he's not already joined Manchester City, because he'll give them everything they want. He'll give them the kind of mentality they thought they were getting with Van Gaal, guaranteed results, a genuine style of play that can be deemed as their own, or the Manchester United way.
I think we've obviously got a chat with Kit Holden coming up later, journalist Kit Holden, about Pep Guardiola, but I think Pep Guardiola would be mad to go to United over City. United are such a poorly run club at the moment. City have everything in place for sustained success for years, if not decades now. I think he'd be mad to go to United, that's the way it stands.
The thing is with this, it's all about perception, because let's say I'm on the red half of Manchester. Manchester United have arguably more history. They've got a greater standing in terms of perception in the game. Mm. But Manchester City have got much better infrastructure right now as it stands. They've got more kind of money. They've got a better academy structure. You could argue they're doing a little bit better in terms of transitioning those players from one to the other. And Manchester United at present, as I'm sure Dave's probably touched on, to a much greater knowledge base, haven't been doing that. They've actually been struggling. They've just shipped out, I think, Callum Gribben, who I kept hearing loads of great things about to Preston North End, and they're doing that consistently. Tom Thorpe was another one, was captain of the reserves, heralded as a really big star, then ends up at Rotherham after being released.
And we're talking about Manchester United underperforming, of course. Another team underperforming, Lawrence, Everton, beaten by Swansea at the weekend. They've only actually won one the last 10 games in the Premier League. Roberto Martinez is now coming under a lot of pressure, particularly for the way he plays. And there's a suggestion that it's either naivety or arrogance that he refuses to perhaps play with a more defensive mindset. I mean, what do you make of that?
I don't get the personification of journalists' words very often. And people sort of making the public image out of a lot of these things. I'm not quite sure what people believe about Martinez. I do think Everton fans are very intelligent footballing fans. I think a lot of people are making judgments from outside the club who don't watch an awful lot of Everton and don't quite know what Everton fans want. So I'd be careful to make broad conclusions about where the club are going. I think for a while, Everton have been a team that have been in purgatory. Not that they're dead, but they've been stuck between the old Premier League, which is, you know, the early years where they still had the owners and people beginning to make money, but looking at selling, and they've never been able to sell until this point. And I think now they're looking for someone to sell to. And I think then they will start to make their decisions. And I think then that's what they're holding out for, essentially. Mm. And for that, and I think they found a lot of buyers, but I think that, you know, they've been very careful, and rightly so. I think they're right to stick with Martinez for now, because again, if you get rid of Martinez, who are you going for?
I'm not suggesting they're going to get rid of Martinez. I don't think they will. But I mean, Kristen,
well, they don't have a great record.
It's true,
but I mean, at the moment, but they are playing more beautiful football, and they are getting. They are getting some good football out of some players there.
Conceding a lot of goals though, Kristen.
That essentially for me, what you're seeing being played out is a very similar situation to the one he found himself in at Wigan, where a lot of people,
but they don't have
the
a racist owner, and in many ways I think legally they did not have a racist owner at Wigan either.
That's how I dropped the scoop that Everton's owner's a massive racist. Bill Kenwright is not, by the way. He's one of the nicest men in football.
One of the nicest men in football. You're right.
Provided you fit a few criteria.
That's not true again.
Again, not true. Total joke. He is a really nice guy. I know a few people who've had dinner with him and such. But what I mean by that is,
I just want to check.
I don't think so. Had they been on holiday? No, can't remember. They play very beautiful football in terms of the technical ability and the possession. It doesn't achieve a great deal. It achieves enough to keep them in the league. Now, the difference was that at Wigan, the budgets were significantly smaller. And if anything, they were seen as punching above their weight consistently, largely because they had to sell players. I'm not surprised if Kenwright maybe saw a benefit to hiring Martinez in that sense, because he thought, you know what, we're in a similar financial position where we need to sell to keep ourselves above the water. So having someone who can adapt like that is brilliant. The problem you have is that actually, in the end, Wigan went down, and you're seeing a lot of the same tropes play out, because they're conceding too many. I think they're a little bit over elaborate in play sometimes. I certainly think maybe John Stones typifies that with the needless
The fans are getting on his back now, aren't they? Every time he sort of does a Cruyff turn or brings the ball out and maybe takes one too many touches, the fans turn on him.
I think I admire his eagerness to be a ball-playing defender. England need more of them, undeniably. There comes a point where that confidence becomes complacency, though.
Do you think that's symptomatic of Martinez, though? Because he's famously a man who once said, you know, he doesn't believe in, you know, systems and keeping clean sheets and not taking risks. He is very all or nothing with regards to the way he wants to play football.
Brilliant.
But do you not think he needs to be more pragmatic? Manifest that.
So look at Mark Warburton. I remember having a chat with one of the Brentford fan blogs. What is it? Is he Besotted something? Lawrence, you'll know this. You've
familiar
with
Besotted,
well.
Yeah.
Besotted, yeah.
Yeah. And he told me a really cool anecdote about Warburton that he will never settle for a draw because he sees it as better to risk the potential loss and pick up a win than just settle for a draw. So if it gets to like the last 10 minutes, he'll throw on a striker instead of a defender. And I think it's a similar mentality to Martinez, but it's the way it manifests in the sense that I imagine Warburton has a similar way of thinking, but his comes to the fore in a much more positive way for the team. I'm not sure if it does for Martinez. I think sometimes he gets a little bit too mired in, while he doesn't say the style he wants the team to play, even if it's not recognised, if that makes sense.
But you look at those results, like I mentioned earlier, 1-10 is awful form. And that came against Newcastle, that one win. I mean, Lawrence, you seem...
Which was fortuitous as well, I think. They've only had 3 wins since September, and they've all come against the teams in the bottom 3.
Exactly. I mean, Lawrence, do you not agree that maybe, although Roberto Martinez, the way he wants to play the game, is admirable, that there are times when you do need to show pragmatism and try and shut out a game? I mean, against Chelsea a few weeks ago, the 3-3 draw, Everton go 3-2 up, minutes left to play. They refuse to, say, do... you know, what you'd say, a smart tactic, keeping the ball, trying to run down the clock. They refused to do that. They almost looked like they were trying to go for another goal.
Yeah.
And then they end up dropping 2 points.
I see where you're coming from. I'm probably just taking another view because it makes more interesting conversation.
It's true.
Martinez is coming from. I see the all or nothing nature of it. And I think, you know, it's all well and good people paying lip service to that. They talk about other managers being, you know, having their philosophy and those kind of things. Credit to him for sticking with that. And, we talk about pragmatism and all those kind of things and how, and I'd be very interested to think about the idea of, you know, the mixture of theory and practice and how actually being a football manager is, you know, the apex of that, because you have to be practical, but also have your ideas and express those to the players really well. I think over time, if he was to stay, they probably would get that. But you know, there is almost a sense of inertia around the club because, you know, they almost go, well, you know, what more are we going to do under this manager? But the problem is, I think there's so many, it's, put it this way, it's almost meta. I don't know how to describe it. And Kristen, maybe you have the same. We spend so much time navel gazing and analyzing. And to some extent, I think that the analysis and influence of the crowds, and influence of all the people who go and watch the game, and influence everything from outside the club, sometimes crushes inwards and influences negatively the project that's going on there. And to some extent, I think that that is part of the problem that modern day managers face. And I think Martinez very much faces that, is that there's so many people who aren't actually involved in football. I'm not actually involved in football. I just happen to be interested in it and have a job where I talk about it and, you know, make videos about it and try and analyze it in an almost faux intellectual way. It's the same with a lot of people. I know there are a lot of people out there that have studied it, but those people aren't doing it, essentially. And I think a lot of that can crush in, and that happens on fan cams, that happens on articles, that happens in videos, that happens in ESPN, it happens in Sky, it happens everywhere. It's people who are part of the product, but not part of the love of the, you know, it's love of the game, but not in the same way, if that makes sense. I'm not saying that makes us any less authentic, but I think it changes the way that clubs like Everton have to operate. To some extent, it takes away some of the romance of what Martinez can do and the style of football he wants to play. And I think it sort of wants people to fit inside a certain box. And when they don't fit inside that box, then we go, well, then you're not fit.
And I don't think that works. And to some extent, I have a lot of sympathy with him for that reason, because I think the analysis lets him down time after time because people have got the box that he needs to fit within. Because if you don't fit in the Premier League box, then you very often you get relegated.
But I appreciate what you're saying. You know, we're people outside of the game. We can only judge on what we see. Of course, I'm sure I wouldn't do any better a job managing Everton if I suddenly took the hot seat. But all we can judge is what we can see. And the most clear example of that is the results. And you look at Everton, you look at that squad. You know, you
what
look
are
at
the
Lukaku.
Results? Okay, then let me ask you this. What are the results? They lose, right? And I understand the fans are frustrated by that because they believe they should be in the Champions League. And, you know, to some extent, I can sympathize with that.
Not even be in the Champions League, but not.
Champions well. League, Europa League, just traveling anywhere. It's just good to get out.
Go somewhere.
Busy awesome. Midweek.
Yeah, exactly. And... you know, I can sympathise with that, but at the same time, the results are also, you're seeing some fantastic goals at Goodison Park this season. You're seeing some brilliant football at Goodison Park this season. You're having some experiences that a 1-0 will not deliver to you, or will deliver, but over a much, almost on a drip. You're getting it when the tap's fully turned on.
Yeah, but I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You look at, say, Spurs. We're playing fantastic football and getting the results that have now...
Yeah, but he's not at a club that is structured in the same way as Spurs.
Do you not think Everton should be, the way the season's going, the way the Premier League's panning out this season, though, they should be almost up there with West Ham, say, Man United, only a couple of points off of Spurs.
But then the point you're making comes from your model. So, and I see what you're saying. I see that we exist in the Premier League era, but the point that you're making comes from okay, then if you fit inside the box, which Daniel Levy has for years, and he's had that foresight, and in the same way that Arsene Wenger has and a couple of other people in the Premier League have had, then that's good. You fit there. But there's not very much leeway, is what I'm saying, in football for people who are innovative thinkers on other strands of football.
Your train of thought because of Leicester. Who are now top of the Premier League.
That's someone who's arguably the antithesis of Martinez. He's a lot more pragmatic. That's when I look at Martinez, he reminds me a lot, and this will be quite a niche reference, of Caleb Porter, the coach of the Portland Timbers, in the sense that Porter arrived in Major League Soccer with a very idealistic way of playing soccer. He wanted to play possession-based, on the floor, like he had at Akron University. I think he quickly realised you couldn't do that every single week and get success at the same time. So what he's done over the course of the time he's been with the Timbers is he's become more pragmatic. He's built a side that can play a few different ways, that can be a bit more direct if they need to. He's found a balance in midfield where he's got someone who pulls the passes, someone who's a lot more athletic and can get up the field, and then someone in Diego Chara who can just sit and break stuff up. I don't see that same balance and pragmatism with Martinez, and he's had roughly the same amount of time as Caleb Porter has at the Timbers. And that would be my concern if I'm an Everton fan, is we have a young, in air quotes, progressive manager. How progressive is he being with himself in terms of analysing what he's doing and trying to move the team forward?
That's what I think the point is,
within his own bubble.
Well, we're talking about underperforming teams here. How about we talk about a team who are playing very well? Juventus, Christian.
Oh.
They've just beaten Roma on the weekend. 11 wins in a row now. Paulo Dybala, of course, is the man of the moment.
Was Daniele De Rossi.
Well, let's not get into that at the moment. They're still, you know, 2 points off the top of the table, chasing Napoli in Serie A. But what have you made of Juventus this season? Because obviously, when the season kicked off, things weren't looking so good.
I'm going to sound like a slight hypocrite here with this transition. Ooh. I think where Juventus have benefited from is they've been true to themselves and stuck by what they believed in. Mm-hmm. In the sense that they've turned it round by slowly chipping away at things and believing in the style and the ideology that the club wanted to put forward, and just being consistent, maintaining that and believing that things would turn around eventually, that things would pick up. Again, Dybala. I look in Europe, I can't think of many clubs who've done better in the transfer market consistently than Juventus when you think about it. When they got Pogba for free, they got Pirlo for free. Yeah, Dybala was a big money signing. I think he's paid a good chunk of it back already. I appreciate the kind of humility he showed and saying that he didn't think he was worth kind of the fee that was paid for him. I think he's worth that and a little bit more now. If you look at the context of the market and what other strikers are going for, he looks a really sensational little player, and I've really enjoyed watching him.
Of course, as well, he's replaced Tevez in a way. I think the headline on Tutto Sport from the weekend was Tevez who. You've also got the likes of Sami Khedira, who came in over the summer, perhaps to replace Vidal. I mean, how would you assess their squad in terms of not just the league, but, you know, we're going to be talking to Kit Holden later on about how Bayern Munich are taking on in the Champions League. Do you think they're set up for success in both domestic and European competition?
I think that is a big ask. The benefit they had last year when they made that run was a bit like Bayern. They were running away with the domestic league. This year, they've got a bit more of a challenge because Inter Milan, I think, again, did some relatively smart business, at least compared to their cross-city rivals, AC Milan. So they've got more of a challenge domestically, and they're going to need to manage that a lot more than I think they had to last season, which then means how do you split your time between that and the midweek games?
If well, I can say one thing about Allegri, between Inter he's good. And Juventus, yeah.
That's what I would say about Allegri compared to Conte, is that he's got a bit of a better grip on that. He understands that you don't have to run the car at 100 miles an hour every game, that you can let it cruise at 60 and still come out with the result you need. And his game management, I think, is a little bit better than Conte's. That's going to be tested, I think, this season. And personally, if I was having to put £10 down on it, I'd be very surprised if Juventus made it as far as they did last season. I think they'll go out a little bit earlier.
What about with regards to the league then? Do you see them winning the league? I think, how many consecutive times would that be? Is that four now? Five?
Four?
Or do you see Napoli sort of streaking ahead and keeping up the level of performance that they are at the moment?
I'd really like Napoli to do it. There's a lot to admire about that club. They feel a little bit like, to me at least, like a ragtag band of players. There's not as maybe much refinement when I look at that club. Certainly the players are brilliant and have got immense pedigree, like Higuain. I also quite enjoy the fact that Nathaniel Chalabar's in there. I think it would be great from an English perspective, to be really selfish, to have an Englishman win a foreign league title like that and get that experience and get that feeling. I also think they played some of the best football in the first half of the season. Largely that was also down to Higuain's form, which will need to be maintained. And that's my one big question with them, was last season when they needed Higuain to do something for them and they needed him to be that clutch player, to borrow an American sports term, he wasn't. He let them down. He didn't get them into the Champions League because I think he missed a penalty and a few other chances. It's a lot of pressure to put on a man, but I think he'll thrive off that, at least I hope anyway. It's showing whether he's been able to evolve and grow himself and prove that Real Madrid would be naive to let someone like him go, that he can be this game changer.
It's kind of the point, isn't it? Is that, you know, when it did come down to the game against Inter, you know, we were looking for him to come through there and he was subbed off. And, you know, Inter ended up winning that on 2-0. And that was only,
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, that was, 2 weeks ago now? Yeah, a week ago.
Yeah.
Let's finish up the old news section with a bit of transfer news, Kristen. Andros Townsend set to move to Newcastle. £12 million fee agreed with Spurs. He's only made 3 substitute appearances in the Premier League this season for Tottenham. Do you think that's a good move both for the player and the club?
I think it's definitely a good move for him. I think he needs to get away from Spurs. It's not beneficial to his career at this point to stay there, because he doesn't fit the frame. And that's not to say he's a bad player, because I think as potentially could fit much better at Newcastle. What I mean by that is the way Pochettino wants to play, the idea of winning the ball high up the field, being quite quick with it, being quite intricate with it, that's never really struck me as Andros Townsend's game. For me, he's always been a very conventional, traditional, arguably simplistic winger. Someone that likes to drive at defenders, go past them very easily.
Cut in.
Yeah, be it cut in and shoot, swing a ball in, whichever. But it's very simple, and I don't think Pochettino's system, at least for his attackers and his wide players, accommodates that kind of player. So it was never really going to be a good fit for him.
What about Newcastle then? Because we've struggled to pin down what Steve McLaren's actual system is. But do you think he'll be a good fit?
I would like to think so, and I say that because if you look at Moussa Sissoko and the role that he fills and what he is usually doing, it's a similar skill set, I would argue, to that of Andros Townsend. It's picking up the ball, it's going past someone very easily, it's using your athleticism rather than intricate skill, and it's catching teams theoretically on the counter-attack like they did against Liverpool with Wijnaldum second. That's kind of their perfect moment for Newcastle tactically. I've got to believe that someone with his skill set could fit into that side and arguably give them a little bit more balance by playing on the left, because they've tried a few different guys out there. They've tried Perez, who loves to cut inside and is really a striker that's better suited in a front three rather than a 4-2-3-1. They've put Wijnaldum out there, who just totally drifts out of the game because he's a central player if I've ever seen one. And even Tovan, who it looks, I would imagine, will head off to Marseille not long after this deal's completed. Again, not really quick enough for what they want him to do, and his crossing is a little bit hit and miss as well. So I'm inclined to think, yeah, he's a much better fit in that sense. Whether it's £12 million worth of better fit, only time will realistically tell.
Elsewhere, Lawrence, it does look like Alexandre Pato is going to join Chelsea on loan for 6 months.
Brilliant. Good for him. I like Pato. I've missed him in Europe. I'm glad he's not going to China.
Like Jovinho or Ramirez.
It'd be good to see what he does. It'd be good to see what he does in the team.
And you actually got high hopes for him. Do you think he can cut it in the Premier League?
He's not the same player who left the Premier League, that's for sure. Left Europe. He never left the Premier League. Right. In my mind, he should have been in the Premier League from the very beginning, playing for a club like Liverpool. But he had to leave because of what happened outside the Premier League. And I think as he comes back, he's not going to be the same pacey player. He's still got some skills. I think he's probably going to be used as an impact squad player. What's going to be interesting is to see whether Chelsea, or he sort of uses this as a shop window to, go even further. I think it would be so unusual if Chelsea were to keep him in the end. But
10 million, apparently, if they want to sign him.
Maybe looking to be good. I don't think they'll get 10 million in the end.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're finding, is that they couldn't sell him. And so they're having to loan him. Right. Because the whole point is, whether they want to get the money for him or whatever, they'll probably get a loan fee, which will be, relatively good. But at the same time, they'll also get his wages off their books, which is what they want.
Obviously, his arrival, Chris, means that maybe like Remy, Radamel Falcao, or both could be leaving. Suggestions that Remy could be another signing for Steve McLaren.
Yeah, well, he's obviously been there before and did well. He had I think it was actually a better than 1-2 record. I want to say he got something like 14-26.
No way.
So if he's trying to make a late push for that France squad, familiarity is not a bad idea in terms of getting some brief form till the end of the season.
Great.
Equally, the fact that Palace have just picked up Adebayor, I don't know if they're going to want to bring someone else in as well who's likely to be on big wages. It makes a lot of sense for both parties, as does Falcao departing. In terms of Pato's success, I think it goes one of two ways. It's either like Ross and Rachel and Friends, where it should have happened the 7 years ago that it was supposed to, or it's like hooking up with someone that you went to high school with. It's not a good idea because you've both changed drastically since that moment. I would like to think he'll do well. I think he's got enough speed to thrive in this league. There's enough openness and enough attacking opportunity for someone like him. And I'm just looking forward to watching him. I appreciate that, we don't always get to do that. Yeah, he seems a nice guy.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
it could certainly go. It could certainly go either way. Another move which could certainly go either way, Chris, is Emmanuel Adebayor's Crystal Palace. Palace have signed him. Reported $77,000 a week wages. Obviously on a free transfer. A player who's renowned for being able to perform in short spells. Palace need goals. It could be a bit of a masterstroke.
If ever there was an ego that could ignite Emmanuel Adebayor,
it's Pards.
It's Pardew. And not only, have you heard the story that Harry Redknapp told when he was on Soccer? I think it was Soccer Saturday, or, you know, one of those shows.
Please, thanks.
And he says they used to give, for the worst player of the week, used to vote for the worst player of the week, and they'd have to give £1,000 to charity. And he did.
No, it was 50 quid.
Was it 50 quid? Okay, so it wasn't even that, right? And he walks into training, he's not given the 50 quid, clearly. And one of the other players turns to him and says, Emmanuel, you've not given the money. Come on, you're on 210,000 a week. I can't believe you're not giving the money. He goes, no. I'm on 250,000 a week. And they're like, okay, that's not the point.
We said Bissong went up to him and went, come on, man. You know, you're on £210,000 a week. You can afford 50 quid for the children's hospital that they done it. And he stopped him and went, no, Seb, I'm on £225,000 a week.
And you're like, mate, you're not helping yourself here.
Well, Chris, and you
also,
think
at the same time,
this changes everything. Sorry,
I
mate.
I can't believe how much he was on.
Oh, yeah. His wages at Spurs are being subsidised by a city, weren't they? So it was something insane.
That's
he was earning.
Yeah, that is crazy. He's
Chris,
not
regardless of his, you know, his controversial reputation and what he does off the pitch, on the pitch he could have the desired impact.
He could. He's certainly a talented player. He has brought goals with him realistically wherever he's been. Even that period where he was ostracised by Tottenham, when he came back into the side, he did well. You can't argue with that. The difficulty is how long term is he? I think Palace have done well to hedge their bets by giving him 6 months. I think that works well with both parties. But even then, I wouldn't be surprised if Adebayor manages to find a way to pee everybody off in those 6 months. And equally, as you touched on there, he's being managed by Alan Pardew. And I found it personally quite laughable that he said he handled Haddon Ben Arfa. And I even wrote something for Yahoo Sport this week.
Indeed.
To that sentiment, saying that if he thinks he handled Haddon Ben Arfa, he's got a massive case of revisionist history. Because if anything, he had him good for a few months, still didn't grasp how he was supposed to use him properly, and then forced him out of the club for a free transfer. It was, again, it was a case of a man who had no idea what he was actually dealing with and thought that he could treat him like any other player that he dealt with.
Is that a worrying sort of precedent then, that perhaps Pardew doesn't know how to manage these sort of mercurial talents, these difficult personalities?
That's in fairness, that's always been Pardew's issue. I don't think he's a terrible manager. I think at Newcastle he became a bad manager, partly because he had no flexibility in him. And Newcastle needed that same flexibility that, say, Everton need, because they're all about selling stars to fund the next generation. And at that kind of club, you need someone who is flexible at the helm. And whether it was his tactics in terms of being able to evolve and shift the focus to a different part of the team, or dealing with characters that, again, were more talented than should have been at Newcastle, but had issues, he just couldn't do it. It was the same with other Flair players, like Remy Cabella. Couldn't integrate him properly, had him sitting on the bench when he cost me like 10, 12 million. He's just not very good with those players that need a little bit more sort of care and attention and a little bit more integration into a side.
Well, that brings us to the end of the news section. After this, we're going to be back with this week's talking point. Right, so it is time for this week's talking point. Our guest this week is journalist Kit Holden, who's here to talk to us about Pep Guardiola. Kit, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you here. Obviously, I got in touch with you because you wrote a little article about Pep Guardiola last week for the Mail Online. As you sort of outlined there, Pep has officially entered the final 6 months of his contract at Bayern Munich, and it seems that you've certainly be coming to the Premier League after 3 years in Bavaria. You were sort of suggesting that if he doesn't win the Champions League this season, those 3 years will be seen as a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of will by everybody, but I'm not sure if he'll see them as a disappointment. That's the interesting thing. I mean, it's kind of understood that he arrived at the club after they just won the treble in 2013, and he arrived in order to carry on that success, which is obviously huge expectations, which no coach could have done completely. But I mean, I think, yeah, after 3 years, there'd be a lot of people who would be quite disappointed if he hadn't won a Champions League. But I think from his point of view, he's very happy with the work he's done. And he feels that, you know, it was all about a process and about bringing his style to a new country and about, getting the players to develop themselves in different ways. And to be honest, Bayern are a completely different team now. They're a far better team now, and if you look at pure playing style. So, I mean, he came up, I think I put it in the piece, that he came up with this sort of rather glib comment a few weeks ago, where he said, you know, titles and trophies are just numbers, which I think can be taken with a pinch of salt, but it does kind of show that he feels that for all the pressure to win the Champions League, he feels job done.
Do you think the perception of him is at Bayern Munich in terms of, it seems over here that it's seen par for the course to win those league titles the way he's done. That's the bare minimum almost.
Kind of. I mean, I think that's sometimes slightly overstated. I mean, they Bayern are always expected to be the favourites for the title, and they're generally expected to win it. But to be fair on Guardiola, the last two seasons they've won it, I think by 9 and about 20 points, respectively. They don't normally win it by that much. Again, Jupankis in the season before Pep arrived, he also won with over 20 point gap, or around a 20 point gap, which was an astonishing achievement and was you know, celebrated high and wide. And then Pep comes in, and the expectations are to match that, like I say. And so even when he wins the title in March for earlier than anyone has ever done it before, it's kind of seen, everyone goes, oh, well, that's par for the course. Well, not really. I mean, he has won the Bundesliga, which does have some very good teams in it, like Dortmund, like Schalke, like Wolfsburg in the last couple of years. And he's won it very, very convincingly in both years. And I think, but the trouble is that, yes, in terms of the trophy he has in his hands at the end of the season, that doesn't make him any different to pretty much the vast majority of other Bayern coaches over the last 30 years. They've almost all of them have won it. Same with the German Cup. And the thing that will distinguish him is the Champions League title.
So how do you think he would describe what he's done at Bayern? Like, what do you think he would identify as the main things he's achieved?
Well, certainly playing style.
But what specifically? Because, I mean, it's we're saying it's not par for the course. They are also the most powerful political team in Germany as well. So mm-hmm. they do get a lot of things not done for them. But, you know, they tend to work with the right people. They can bring anyone in they want to. Mm-hmm. What exactly is he? What's the minutiae of his that sort of style? And what has changed about Bayern in that time that's made them maybe even more dominant?
So if you look at how they were under Heinkes, I mean, it was obviously a very, very strong team. It won the treble and beat some very good teams along the way. And it was already full of world-class players. But if you look at some of those world-class players who are still there, Philipp Lahm, for example, has developed, having been a right-back for most of his career, has now developed into one of the most versatile defensive players in the world, if not the most. I mean, he plays, Guardiola can play him as a right back, as a kind of central defensive midfielder, as a right defensive midfielder with two defensive midfielders. He can play him as a winger. He can play him as almost anything. And I think he's brought out, and Lahm, I think, always had that potential, but was often, and because he is a very professional and sort of dutiful player and man, he always just did his job at right back very, very well and didn't complain. And then suddenly he was given this new lease of freedom under Guardiola. There are others. I mean, Müller, for example, I think is a player who his personality is often clashed with Guardiola on a low level. If he's not been in the starting 11 all the time or whatever because of the rotation, but in terms of again his playing style, which is indescribable at times and very much in the kind of Guardiola mold of not having specific positions, particularly in attack, and that flexibility and that creating space from nothing and all those things, I think that's brought the best out in Müller. If you look at the individual players and the way they were playing before and the roles they had, the roles they have now are certainly far more diverse, far less easy to define, which makes Bayern much more difficult to kind of second guess, if you like, which is why you now see a lot more teams, even in the Bundesliga, just going for straight up parking the bus when they play Bayern before they do anything else, which they didn't used to quite as much because you can't predict them now. And I think, at their very best, they are incredible to watch. I mean, I think everything is judged by trophies, and that's right. And I think, you know, obviously the Barcelona and Real Madrid teams of the last 2 years have done better in Europe than Bayern have, but they're very, very best at those best moments. There hasn't been a team that's been so brilliant to watch as Bayern since Guardiola left Barca.
What's the current context then? We're looking at that Champions League triumph that obviously Pep is aiming for, and in many ways he almost needs to win, as you're saying. How are they set up now for that success? Because there's been a number of injuries in recent weeks as well, going into the fixture, which is coming up in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, and I think that they've got a very, very deep squad in general. So, I mean, for example, when a player like Robin or Ribéry gets injured, they've now got the likes of Douglas Costa and Kingsley Coman, who can come in and play almost exactly the same role in that team, and they've got that backup now. And obviously in attacking midfield, they've got a wealth of players. The key one, I think, that could harm them over the next few months is Boateng, who was injured at the weekend and is looking at a very long spell on the sidelines. And he was really having an absolutely fantastic season. One of the interesting things Guardiola has started to do with Bayern is when teams are parking the buses, he's got them playing the long balls, very, very sort of pinpointed long ball football, which is completely against what everyone thinks is his style, but has worked brilliantly. It worked against Dortmund when they couldn't break them down, and suddenly they burst into life with these long balls from Boateng and beat them 5-1. And Boateng too has mastered his temperament. He always used to get a lot more red cards in the past, and he's now a much more mature player. He's a much better leader. And he's really crucial for Bayern, not just in defence but also in attack. And I think that could really harm them that he's out for such a long period. Mm. They've always had a lot of injuries. There's a lot of sort of stuff in the Munich tabloids about is it Pep's fault that they always get so many injuries? Possibly. They have a very deep squad. They should be all right against the likes of Barcelona and Real and the really top teams. And then the like if someone like Boateng is not there, then they could struggle.
Before they even meet the likes of Barcelona and Real, they've of course got to get past Juventus, the first leg of which is away from home on the 23rd of February. Are you tipping them to navigate that one successfully?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a banana skin, definitely, because it's not a very kind draw. But I think, you know, it's Bayern. Also, they bought two of Juventus' best players in the summer, so they kind of were a step ahead of the game there in some ways. And yeah, I think certainly they'll be backing themselves to win that game and to win those two games. And but it is difficult, and you know they've had a few slip ups against Gladbach. They were taken part and against Arsenal as well by very, very good counter attacking teams that really exploited their weaknesses fantastically. So they're not a perfectly running machine at the moment, but I think certainly they're good enough to get past that.
And do you think Pep Guardiola can win it this year then? And if so, what is different this year to previous years? Barcelona are still the favourites, of course, but do you see Bayern maybe pipping them to it?
Yeah, I think they can. I think it all depends really on whether or not Guardiola manages to find a solution to a problem which he's had over the last 2 years, which is that once they have the title in the bag in late March or early April, in both years they've then dropped off. Guardiola has purposely rested his key players, but all the focus is on the Champions League games, and it's created a kind of a huge psychological pressure and a certain rustiness as well, which has seen them completely capitulate against Real in 14 and against Barca in 15 in the Champions League. And he needs to, if Bayern, which they look like they might do if they win the title again just as early this year, then he needs to find a way of keeping them in the right frame of mind for when the semi-finals come along, if they do get that far and they start playing the big teams, because it's been the one thing that he's got wrong, completely wrong, in both seasons, and he said it himself. And if they're going to win it, they're going to have to do that, because they have the quality to beat Barca and Real, but they also have the capacity to lose to them, obviously. And it's very much, I think, in those Champions League semi-finals about form on the day and mentality on the day. And that's what Bayern have lacked in the last 2 years.
Looking beyond this season then, Guardiola said himself that he's looking to come to the Premier League, Manchester City, obviously the team he's expected to join this summer. What do you make of that marriage, if you will? Does that fit for you?
Yeah, I think it does. Partly because of Bielsa and Soriano, who were, and the biggest sign particularly was there was the guy at Barcelona who got him the head coach job and really plugged for him in the Barca board when they were humming and ahhing as to whether to give such an unexperienced man the top job. So he's got very much a kind of a debt to pay, I think, to those two, Vigoristo and Soriano at City. And he also have a very good working relationship with them. You know, they'll know exactly how he works and exactly what he wants. City also have a system in place where they will offer him everything. I mean, one thing he's had at Bayern is pretty much everything, but there's been certain things which the club have refused to back down on. There's been certain things where, even if they have backed down, the fans have been very annoyed with him for resting certain players or having fights with the club doctor or things like that Bayern fans don't take kindly to. And I think Guardiola expected perhaps a little more of a free rein at Bayern. I think he would get more of that at City. He's going to have a high quality of players to use if he does go to City. I think it'd be interesting to see whether he goes this summer or if he has another gap here, because he's sort of been mumbling a bit as well about that he might not go to England next year and blah, blah, blah. And I think if the right option doesn't come up immediately and he doesn't have exactly the offer he wants, then he'll take a gap here and he'll come back in a year's time and reassess his options.
So if he does, we're assuming, I'm assuming that he is going to come this summer, but of course, like you say, it's not confirmed yet. You've talked about City there, how he might adapt to that club. What do you think the challenges are that he's going to face coming to the Premier League compared to, say, the Bundesliga or La Liga?
I think, to a certain extent, the Bundesliga was more open to his kind of whole project, which is about basically bringing his philosophy and his entire thoughts and ideas about the way the game is played and putting them into a new football culture. And I think because the Bundesliga doesn't kind of have this kind of merry-go-round of foreign managers and star managers as much as the Premier League does, but also because it is generally a more tactical league. It's more concerned with shapes and with formations and positions than the Premier League is. The Premier League, it is a bit of a cliche, but it's true when you watch it. It is more chaotic. It's more pacey. It's more crazy and fast and physical. And I think there will be certain teams who will come up against where he'll be surprised just how little respect they pay his system. And he's had if he's had one boon from the Bundesliga, it's been the fact that a lot of teams and a lot of managers have sort of almost subtly bowed down before him and his system and tried to play around it. And I think he'll get less of that in the Premier League. But I think he's ready for that. I think that's partly why he wants to do it, because he's really relishing that challenge. But and I think he's good enough to take it on. But I mean,
it's interesting that, so he came out a few days ago and said, you know, he wants new challenges, of course, which you're sort of talking about there in terms of Premier League. He's also said he wants new enemies. You know, you need new enemies to get better, is what he said. There is a very real possibility now that he could come up against Jose Mourinho next season at Manchester United. The way things are going for Louis van Gaal. What's your assessment of that sort of rivalry between them? Because obviously it was very acrimonious in La Liga. Is that something you think maybe he'd relish or maybe he'd succeed at?
I'm not sure about him. I know it's obvious that Mourinho adores that rivalry, and it's very much one that he thrives off, and it feeds Mourinho's whole conception of himself as this great sort of antichrist to sort of the ultimate non-aesthetic party destroyer. But I'm not sure about Guardiola whether he really likes it in that, because he doesn't, although he says he needs new enemies, I think he sees that much more on a kind of academic level, where he wants a new tactical challenge. He wants something else that he has to break down in his eternal chess game. And he doesn't like the whole sort of mind games and the press conferences and the little verbal jabs and everything. He's not very good at it either. He either stays very, very coy, or he stays very, very silent for a long time and then gets incredibly annoyed. I don't think he'd particularly be relishing it, but I think he'd be relishing certainly another opportunity to play Mourinho at chess on the football pitch, but off the football pitch less so, I think.
The other alternative, of course, although he is expected to join Manchester City, that's what the signs are pointing. The rumours that he could go to Manchester United, are refusing to die. There was reports last week that United executives had some sort of secret meeting. I mean, can you see that happening? And if so, do you think that would be a benefit maybe than City?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's sort of wandering around the party at the moment with in a very low cut top and sort of flirting with everybody, isn't he? He's sort of and so I can imagine they're having all these crisis meetings, all these board members who are falling over themselves to gain his favour. But I think he'd go to United if the offer was right for him, because I think he's to a certain extent a football romantic. He likes the grand old clubs, yes. and he would like the kind of romanticism of United. But they'd have to give him in terms of his role in the club's politics, and in terms of the money he'd get, and in terms of the squad he'd receive, and he'd inherit. I think they'd have to give him quite a lot more than they perhaps could give him this summer. They could give him a good enough deal, but I think he'd probably go for City if it were this summer. But I thought that comment about him when he said that he might not go this summer and that's not set in stone, I thought that was interesting, because I think if he is to go somewhere like United, then he'd probably take a year and wait for them to build the squad and work behind the scenes with the board members to say, look, this is what I want to come into, and you've got to make this for me over the next year, and then I'll join.
Do you think he's done enough with youth at Bayern? Because I look at that squad and I look how consistently they buy the likes of Douglas Costa, and it feels as if they could have done more with youth. You've got Hojbjerg at Schalke, who arguably I think could be contributing to the first team, and I'm curious if you feel he's done as much as he possibly could have with the infrastructure of that youth academy.
Yeah, it's another one of the huge criticisms against him is that he hasn't done enough at all. And there have been certainly, Højbjerg is one of those players where he certainly, at the start he came in and he said, oh brilliant, you know, I've got these young players. And Højbjerg was very much the one that he saw as that he was going to mould in his own image and was going to become the sort of the next Guardiola, the Guardiola of his generation as a player. And then he went on into Augsburg, which is, you know, they've done that all through the last 20 years by, and they've loaned out their best young players on short-term leases. David Alaba was at Hoffenheim, for example. Lahm was at Stuttgart. And then everyone expected Højbjerg to come back from Augsburg and then be in the first team, like you say, but because they had such a depth in their squad, he didn't, and then so it's a way to Schalke. And I think Højbjerg will eventually come back, but there are others. I mean, Galdino has left, and Sinan Kurt, and Mitchell Weiser, and these are players who, when they did get a chance with Guardiola, they did look like they were getting something out of him, and he was working really well with them. But I think the squad is too big in many ways, and he has kind of stifled that development. There's also the thing, though, that actually with the whole focus on Guardiola, the quality of player that is coming out of the Bayern youth system has actually, I think, gone down in the last sort of 5 or 6 years since that generation of Schweinsteiger and Miller and Lahm and players like that. If you look at the players, Emre Can was the great, supposed to be the great new Bayern leader who would come out and be Bayern captain and the next Schweinsteiger or the next Lahm. And he's a good player, but he's not quite what everybody expected him to be 5 years ago. And they've had a lot of politics sacking various and having changes of manager in that youth setup and things. And it's not quite as tight as it was maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Mm. And I think Guardiola's presence hasn't helped that.
I noticed you touched on Kurt there as well. That one really struck me as quite bizarre, because obviously they got him from Gladbach and he wasn't there long. Was there given any kind of explanation closer to the ground in Munich in Germany as to why it just didn't pan out? Because he seemed a decent talent to me. Now he's at Hertha.
Yeah, I mean, but Mitchell Weiser are the same. I mean, you know, exactly the same story, that a very young kid with a lot of talent, and Bayern go, okay, we'll have him. And he was at Cologne and, you know, one or two first team appearances and then a few years later off you go. And there have been many in the past in the same vein. And the thing is, sometimes they pay off. Sometimes they arrive at first team football. They, you know, they come in, they play in the youth system for a couple of years, and then they arrive, they mature into a first team player just at the right time when the club has got the right injury or the right, you know, is looking for exactly that kind of player on the transfer market. Alaba did that, for example. Alaba came in when there were no left backs and Bayern couldn't find a left back for love nor money. And then Heinkes Mate said, right, Alaba, you're going to be a left back, and he became one of the best left backs in the world within a year. But you know, if they'd had a really, really good quality left back at that time, we could be looking at a very, very different David Alaba who was playing, yeah, for Hertha or something. I think sometimes there is that, just that element of luck to it. But also, yeah, game time, and if there isn't space even to kind of fill in, I mean, what those kind of players have played at those few games at the end of the season where they've already won the title and they're kind of, you know, all, everyone's concentrating on the Champions League. And that doesn't really make it the best atmosphere in which to integrate or to gain proper first team football or anything like that.
I guess for every Roda there's a Kirchhoff then.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, Kirchhoff's slightly different because he'd established himself as a sort of decent player, and he was one of those that they kind of bought because he'd be a good squad player, and then when he fulfilled his use as a squad player, they sold him on. But the sad stories are the ones like the Kurz and the Weisers who go in. But they do. I mean, there's a funny story about Mitchell Weiser where when he joined Hertha at the start of the season, he did a kind of interview with the club's Hertha's official TV, and the guy said, "Mitchell, what's your aims for the season?" And Mitchell Weiser automatically said, "Well, of course, we'll be playing for the title." And then they went cut because nobody at Hertha wanted him to say that because obviously they won't. And but the Bayern mentality had obviously been instilled into him so forcefully over the last 3 years. So I mean, yeah. Hopefully, you hope that players like that can take what they do get at Bayern and exploit it elsewhere. And, you know, we'll see.
That's what we've got time for. Kit, absolute pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming on. I think we're going to have you on again because that was fantastic.
You're very welcome.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.